Welcome to Intuitive Transformations with your host, Sylvia Henderson, and discover tools, wisdom, and inspiration that will empower you to transform your life. Sylvia is an intuitive life coach and energy healer with a growing practice that is focused on empowering others to be more of who they want to be. For the next hour, join Sylvia and explore and unravel anything in the way of you creating the life that you would love to live on the Om Times Radio Network.
Well, hello and welcome to the Intuitive Transformations radio show, where you will find tools that you can use to change and transform your life every Thursday afternoon at 2 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Om Times Radio Network, the voice of consciousness at omtimes.com. This is Sylvia Henderson, your host, and if you would like to learn more about me and the work that I do, then please be sure to visit my website at intuitivetransformations.net. That's intuitivetransformations.net. So today is January 12th, 2017, and it's an emotional time for the world as America says goodbye to President Obama and accepts its new president and government. With what appears to be the beginning of massive ongoing changes for the entire world already in this brand new year, the key I want you to remember is to focus on what you wish to create manifest in the world today and in your own personal life. Please do not allow fearful thoughts to be projected into your imagination, because fear is a crippling and paralyzing energy. You see, your brain cannot tell the difference between imagined fear and an actual physical threat. Your brain can't tell the difference between a real gun being held to your head or your imagined fear that a gun will eventually be held to your head. Your imagination is so powerful and so potent that whatever you imagine to be true actually creates a physiological change within your body. And you may have noticed this whenever you've gone to watch a suspenseful movie or a thriller, reading a book, that your heart begins to race, your breathing pattern changes, your palms may even begin to sweat as you mentally take on the experiences of the actors or the story that you're reading, as if you're experiencing it yourself. And this is just one example among many that proves that your brain cannot tell the difference between a real threat or an imagined threat. It all feels real to the primitive portion of the human brain. So this is why I emphasize and will continue to emphasize the importance of being present and aware of your thoughts if you find your thoughts trending toward fear, worry, and anxiety. You have to recognize that you have a choice in that awareness, and you can choose something other than fear to focus on. And I know it's hard. I know it's difficult. And even if you're not one that's prone to watch the news on a regular basis or follow social media that focuses on political information and world changes and the points of view of others, because even our own personal judgments can create within us a great deal of stress, worry, anxiety, and fear that causes that physiological change in our body. So the changes going on in the world today, they are going to continue to change. We're going to see more and more changes as we move forward into the future. But I do believe that it is possible for all of us to avoid the trap of fear. So as a trained hypnotherapist, I do understand the power of imagination. So to help all of my listeners and all of my clients, I created a free guided imagery healing audio that's designed to help you release fear, worry, and anxiety, especially during times of uncertainty. And you can download this healing audio for free by going to my website and just joining my email group. It's that simple. And please feel free to share this free healing audio with your family and your friends, because we're all in this world together. And it is so important that we move forward together into the future, being aware and being present. And that's how we're able then to create some positive change in our world that is definitely needed today. And so, speaking of positive change, I have a question. How many of you out there are single and are looking for love? Well, let me ask you this other, a few more questions then. Do you find dating to be confusing? Have you found it nearly impossible to find a love relationship that is healthy, secure, and long-lasting? Is how to find love a complete mystery to you and something that seems like it's more work than it's worth? Or are you currently in a love relationship but not happy and not sure really what you should do about that? If you answered yes to any of those questions, then you are in the right place because I have Dr. Stan Tatkin joining today to discuss some simple and effective principles that have been drawn from neuroscience and attachment theory that will help you date smarter, wiser, and help you find the love that you desire. Now, before I bring Dr. Tatkin on, let me share a little bit about him. Dr. Stan Tatkin is the author of Wired for Love, Your Brain on Love, Love and War in Intimate Relationships, and his brand new book, Wired for Dating. Dr. Tatkin has a clinical practice in Southern California. He teaches at Kaiser Permanente and is an associate clinical professor at UCLA. Dr. Stan Tatkin developed the psychobiological approach to couple therapy called PACT, P-A-C-T, and together with his wife, Tracy Boldman Tatkin, founded the PACT Institute. Dr. Stan Tatkin, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Isn't that a mouthful? That's a lot to say. That's a hard thing to say.
What is?
Well. all of that information, including my wife's name.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate that validation that I did a good job there. We all like to be rewarded with positive words. So thank you.
Of course.
I really am super excited to have you on the show because I am single and I really did learn a lot from reading your book, Wired for Dating. It was quite eye-opening for me. And I have to confess, you know, that I've had challenges in the past when it comes to dating. I've been divorced for about 6 years, and it felt as if the whole game had changed after being married for 15 years. So I really do hope that this show is going to help everyone in their love life journey to experience a greater understanding of what makes dating and love relationships successful and what actually works against us. So, for starters, Dr. Tatkin, why did you decide to focus your research and practice on love and relationships?
Well, I have actually from the very beginning as a psychotherapist focused in the beginning with people with very, very difficult situations called personality disorders. I specialized in that and then also in addictions. But I have always been interested in prevention, and that is why early in my practice I started working with mother-infant pairs because I thought that's where we should actually begin to focus, like preventative medicine, preventative mental health. And that led me to adult pair bonding for a couple of reasons. One is I went through my own divorce, which was devastating for me. And I was in the middle of all my studies about infant brain development and attachment and so on. And I found a one-to-one relationship, just about one-to-one relationship, between research in infant attachment and adult pair bonding, marital outcome studies. And so... driven by my own interest, as well as my interest already that was there, I started to work with adult couples, and I started to become, a couple expert without intending to, but that's how life turns out sometimes. I still think in terms of prevention, and when I'm working with couples, I have in mind the children because the children are always affected by the relationship above them. And in writing the dating book, I'm still concerned about prevention because I see marriages come in with no premarital counseling in their experience. And there are so many things that can be avoided when picking a mate, when deciding to dive into a committed relationship. There's so many things to consider that, like, you know, smoking, you know, if you smoke, the chances are you're going to get some kind of smoking-related illness, most likely. There's things that people can do or not do in the dating process and in choosing a mate to commit to that that, if just thought through, could save many years of misery. So, again, my eye is toward prevention here with the dating book.
So, you know, you mentioned something. You spoke about couples getting married without any premarital counseling. You know, one of the things I really appreciated about your book was your discussion about the vetting process, even during the dating aspect of the relationship, and how important that is. But yet, people are really reluctant to allow other people to provide advice about their relationship if they're completely already attached to someone, in terms of, like, and it's not even a long-term attachment. It's like we fall into this fantasy kind of idea of, this is the love of my life. I know that he's the one, or I know that she's the one. And and sometimes I think people steer away from marital counseling before they get married because they don't want someone to say it's not a good fit.
So, well, it's understandable. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you go right ahead.
It's understandable because, you know, nature has some built-in mechanisms here. One such mechanism is to get us to procreate. And there are all these biological measures that are in place when we select a mate for just that purpose. And those measures are not the same as what we consider in modern times as prepping for a long-term relationship. You know, in the, you know, not too distant past, we didn't live very long, so we didn't concern ourselves with that, but now we have to, and that's why we need to talk about what to do after that infatuation wears off.
That's a very, very good point. We'll be back after the break, and when we return, there'll be more of Dr. Stan Tatkin and his new book, Wired for Dating. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
The future of internet radio is here. Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Hello, I'm Miriam Knight of New Consciousness Review, inviting you to my new show where I interview the rising stars of the conscious awakening. We'll explore the many faces of consciousness in action and intriguing perspectives on life, the universe, and everything in between. Join us each Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern on the Rising Stars Show.
Little, I didn't talk for a long time. I was sensitive to lights and sounds, so I built secret hiding places where they couldn't get in. Sometimes I did the same things over and over, until one day I found out I had autism. My family got me help. Slowly, I learned how to live with it better.
Early intervention can make a lifetime of difference. Learn the signs at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
And we're back with Dr. Stan Tatkin. We're talking about his brand new book, Wired for Dating. He's also the author of Wired for Love. I highly suggest for those of you listening that you pick up both of these books because they work very well together. So Dr. Tatkin, before we went into the break, you were just speaking about the whole issue of why individuals resist having others give them advice, good sound advice about whether or not a prospective partner is really a good choice for a long-term relationship. And some of the things you touched upon was how, you know, we're designed to procreate and how we're living longer and how that's kind of changed things. And so can you just finish that thought, please?
Yes, nature doesn't have a plan for a long-term relationship, never did, probably never will. About 4 years max for couples to have a child, and then in the wild we mix up the gene pool. So that's how we work in the wild. But in societies or in our culture, it has been a tradition, basically, that extended family, friends of both sexes would be privy to our mate and would basically sniff them out on both sides, right? And basically give a thumbs up or thumbs down. And the reason for this is because a person fits into that culture they were born into, and to not use that culture for feedback, not to give, you know, direction of what you should or shouldn't do, but to give feedback that this person, you know, you don't look good here. You don't look yourself with this in this couple. There's something we pick up about this person, whatever, that you are wise and you use your social network just to give you feedback. I think it's a reasonable thing to do, and it was built into the tribal cultures, still is a part of that world. And so to not do that, I think, is asking for some trouble. Doesn't mean you have to do what people tell you to do, but to be curious and especially to vet your person with male and female, young and old, because you want to get a sense of how does this person fit in your world and how do you fit in their world. I think it's a small thing to do, but it can save a lot of trouble in the long run.
You know, that's really interesting, because there are cultures that still strongly believe in the arranged marriage, and now this really makes
that's
a
right.
lot of sense, because and why dating is so confusing for everyone, because we're not sure even what we're looking for beyond that initial physical attraction. So let's talk about dating specifically, because it seems like that's where the big ball of wax is in terms of what makes future
right.
long-term relationships so difficult. So why is dating such a challenge? And what is the psychobiological approach to dating that you talk about in your books? And how does that help one to date more successfully? Or is it even possible to date successfully?
Oh, yes, of course. It depends on your definition of dating. And I think that's the problem. Dating there are very few people who love to date. And unfortunately, those people who do love to date aren't marriage material anyway, because they enjoy the dating process. So most of us don't like it. It's like having needles in our eyes, because it's all about performance pressure and having to wade through a bunch of people that we don't want to be with. And it feels like a big waste of time and a lot of energy. And for those of us who aren't outgoing, it's really a stressor. So rather than think of it as dating, we rather think of it as learning how to read people, learning how to be better at people. Be better at Sherlocking people. So you go out with someone, you don't know them, but you're practicing your skills on relaxing yourself, being yourself, paying close attention to the face, to the eyes, to the skin, to slight movements, micro expressions, things in the narrative the other person is saying that's important information to pick up without you looking or appearing to be investigating somebody, because that's a turnoff. And in that way, you're learning people. Even if the date doesn't work out, you're still enjoying learning about a person and how to learn as much as you can in the shortest amount of time without being intrusive. So I think if people think of it in terms of socializing themselves and becoming better and smarter at being able to read people, then the process, I think, could be much more enjoyable.
So, we're living in a world of technology, and online dating is the big thing now. This is how people have decided, this is how I meet someone, either through Tinder or Match.com or eHarmony.
That's right, yeah.
So
right.
How does this play into being able to deduce or Sherlock someone, or really be able to watch all of these things that take a face-to-face meeting versus this online reading a profile?
Yeah. Well, it's hard, because people lie, and people can lie, and if not out and out lie, just stretch the truth on the internet, and everybody knows that. So what you're looking at is not necessarily what is true, but some people get very addicted to the process of swiping left or swiping right, like a slot machine. And so now we have another overlay where it's not simply going to a party or being fixed up with someone. Now you have apps that you can play with, and the apps themselves are fun. And people use them for different reasons. Some people use them for hooking up, not for serious relationship. And I think it complicates things because you're dealing much more with a bigger pool of people, all of whom are strangers, not vouched for by a neighbor or a family or a member or a friend. And so folks are much more vulnerable. That can be more exciting, and it's also more troublesome. But the same rules apply. We only really get to know someone by being face-to-face, eye-to-eye, and eventually skin-to-skin. And it takes really about a year to actually get to know somebody well. The first part of that is mostly our imagination and what we want to see and what we want to hear. But it takes about a year. So it doesn't matter that we have this new technology. The process really has to remain the same. It's a face-to-face deal.
So for individuals, like especially for women who feel, well, the only way I'm going to, I don't want to go to a bar to meet someone. And
right.
All of my friends are married and they don't have any single friends. And they feel that online
right.
dating is their only recourse. What can they do to make sure that they stay safe first and foremost? Because as you've already said, everyone's not always quite honest with their profile and their intentions. So what can women, because being a female, I want to know, do to keep themselves safe? Is that a viable option then to use online dating, knowing all those pitfalls?
Watch the information you give out always. Always meet in a public place that's well lit. And the to and fro is already planned out in terms of your escape plan. If you don't want to be with this person, you always have a way out and a way to go. So the normal cautions that you would you'd put into play anytime you meet a stranger, probably even more so. But I got to say, online dating is a great thing, and there are plenty of people who have met their love of their lives through this process. So, like anything else, there's upsides and downsides, especially to the internet. And it's, I would say being cautious and being very careful about the information you give out is very important. And we're teaching people to also read other people and get information. And if people are learning this, they're going to try to get information from you too.
Gotcha. Is there some kind of a guideline as to how long before you, say you connect with somebody online and you're enjoying
yeah.
having that texting, basically, is what it seems, because you're just typing emails back and forth initially,
That's right.
how long is a good idea to do that before you actually do meet face to face?
I think that isn't such a problem because the whole texting thing, and a lot of people actually do FaceTime and do other, video chatting, so they can see each other's faces. A lot of that accelerates that process. But we're animals that actually, mechanically find out whether someone is safe or not, or attractive or not, in real time and also in person, because we're using a visual mechanism that has to be live and in person in order to actually track the fine muscles of the face and the pupils and so on. But also the smell, we don't, as animals anymore, rely on pheromones as we once did long, long time ago, but it still plays a role. And movement and voice, prosody, all of that plays a role. So even though the video is a reasonable representation of a person's face and voice, it isn't the same as seeing them face to face. So I think if you are reasonably attracted to this person, you like them, you want to continue the conversation, and they're local and it's safe, then the sooner you move into face-to-face, I think the better.
And I totally agree with you, because you really can't know someone unless you're, because you can even feel the energy of that person by being in their presence.
That's right.
Yeah, I think.
And don't forget texting. If we're visual animals, we have more visual centers in the brain than any other. And that's how we basically size people up. Up close is this fine visual mechanism that reads faces. In order to do that, we have to actually be live and in person. Otherwise, we're missing data. And so you're quite right. If we're just on the phone, Or if we're typing, we're imagining the person, and that imagination is our brain filling in a blank. That's not the real person, that's our brain. Our brain will always fill in blanks, and what isn't there will fill in. If we're in a good mood, it's with good stuff. If we're in a bad mood, it's with negative stuff. But it isn't real. It is just the brain's tendency to always loathe a blank space, something we don't know, and we'll fill it in. So the more you can actually experience that person, I think the better you save time.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I love how you are talking about how the brain will fill in information, because in the beginning of your book, you have a story about a gentleman who meets a woman, and they yeah. have this fantastic chemistry that's so instant, and the whole day is a magical day of love at first sight, kind of, and all these hormonal changes that are happening, and then this guy gets a reality check the very next day, actually.
And
I know we only have a few moments before the next break, but can you just kind of, you know, what happens when we have this, and I know that we're wired to procreate, but this guy that you talk about in your book, he completely fills in the blanks that aren't there.
And he's not the only one. He's not the only one.
It's very
most
typical.
Most of the time our brain is, we have to understand that in the beginning we're on drugs, and those drugs are a very clever mix of neurochemicals and hormones that are there to keep us engaged with somebody and remember them when we walk away. But these same neurochemicals also haze our judgment. We're not in full control of our judgment. In fact, we have very poor judgment when we're in the state, which is why I say the vetting process must follow at some point. But one has to remember that things are rarely what they seem. And when we're in the throes of infatuation and novelty, because our brain loves novelty, we are soaring, basically, almost manic in our senses, in our attention, and we can very easily fill in those blanks. And we have to understand that that's what our brain mostly does, is make stuff up. That's what we're mostly doing. Real time is too fast, and therefore we mostly don't know what we're doing at any given point or why, and we're mostly making stuff up. So if people can keep that in mind, maybe they can also keep a witness state about them and be more wise.
So true, so true. The mind is really great at making things up. So we'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned for more of Intuitive Transformations on OhmTimes.com.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, Om Times Radio, IOM FM. As difficult as it is to believe, there are places in Africa where human traffickers sell albino children and their body parts for use in magic rituals. Humanity Healing International is actively working in Uganda to change this paradigm. The Albino Rescue Project finds albino children who are at risk and places them in safe schools and environments where they can learn and grow free from fear. To learn more or to sponsor a child, visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
Hey, let me ask you something. Would you seat your 3-year-old child on a windowsill? Would you seat them beside a lit fireplace or by the deep end of a pool? One last question. Would you seat your child in a car seat that's not correct for them? Car crashes are a leading killer of children ages 1 to 13. Secure their future. Seat them in the correct car seat. For more information, visit safercar.gov/the right seat. A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And we're back. This is Sylvia Henderson with Dr. Stan Tatkin, and we're talking about love and relationships and dating today. And before we went to the break, Dr. Tatkin shared some really golden nuggets. The first one is that things are rarely what they seem to be, and that the mind is really good at filling in the blanks when it doesn't have all of the detailed information. And so one of the things I really appreciate about your book, Dr. Tatkin, is that you give us a guideline of what we should look for if we want to experience a secure, functioning relationship. And I think having that information being our guiding light would probably help us identify the reality of what's happening versus what our imagination wants to, what our mind wants to fill in with imagination. So you offer these five main ingredients that are necessary to create what you call a secure functioning relationship, which I think that's what a long-term relationship is provides for us, ideally, correct?
Yes, we want, that's what we're selling here. We want people to think not in terms of when they're imagining a long-term relationship, and rather than imagine the perfect person, to imagine or even write down the perfect relationship. And of course, that person is missing, they're a question mark, but that person, you know, what would be the principles of governance that would be mutually or shared by the two of you that you would both believe in? Such things as we are, you know, we believe in monogamy, right? We both do that. We believe in telling each other everything. We believe in full transparency. We both do that. We believe in being the first to know. We believe in having each other's backs. We believe in putting the relationship first. All these things that are measures that protect us from each other and from the outside world, which is actually the purpose of pair bonding. When we think of what animals do when they pair bond, not all but many, is that they partner up and they stay partnered to protect each other from predators and from the environment. And in our culture, we don't have that reality yet. Other cultures do. Police cop partners do, because they are bound together to protect each other from the outside danger. And they actually will do secure functioning because their lives are at stake. People in the military do this as well. People in countries where bombs are raining down on them will do this. But in our culture, we are not facing what we think is danger, even though it's always there. And so we don't really look soberly at the real reason why we're together. It's not a luxury. It's a necessity. We're pair bonding to protect each other and from the violent and careless world that we live in, that will serve us things that we will be challenged with, and we'll either be together as a team and protecting ourselves, or we will be like, you know, like toothpicks in the wind. We'll just blow away. And that's what we're trying to get across to people. This is not about love or romance. This is not about sexuality. This is about loyalty, knowing, you know, where your bread is buttered, and putting your hierarchy in a place where you can depend on each other, put your life, you know, in the hands of another person. That is where a different kind of love emerges. And for that, you need time and two people who are very serious about the same things. So think about the relationship, what it should be. It must be good for you, and it must be good for this other person. If it's not, it won't work.
You know, and that's really interesting, because quite often one of the things that couples spar with each other over is that unequal energy. I'm doing more than you to make this relationship work. And so Right. Is that kind of a warning sign? Because I think that women tend to fall into that more than men. Is that what you find as well?
I think it can go either way, both ways. If I'm going into a relationship and I'm saying I want an equal partner, I am a general, that person's a general, we are royalty, we're the executives, and I expect that, true mutuality and collaboration, and here comes somebody who isn't playing by those rules, doesn't believe in them, I pass on that person. That person is a deal breaker. And this, people have to understand that when you see a deal breaker and you ignore it, you're going to come to me several years later and spend a lot of money when you could have taken care of it in the moment, because deal breakers are deal breakers. These are things that cannot be resolved. They're too different, and they will cause trouble. For instance, you know, I want to raise my children Muslim. You want to raise your children Catholic. We come to the precipice. This is a deal breaker. We look at each other and we go, let's buy a house. And we kick the can down the road. And then sure enough, this is going to rear its head. And it was about, you know, so these kinds of things, and I see it all the time. One person doesn't want monogamy, the other person does. Okay, let's get married. One person doesn't believe in telling, I don't think I should tell you everything. I don't think you should tell me everything. The other person believes in full transparency. Okay, let's get married. These are big, big, big mistakes. And so secure functioning partners are adults. They think ahead, they think about the long run, and they think about what matters. Safety and security, if that is not there, there's no reason to be together at all. You have to wonder why you're together, what's the purpose, what's the point. It's all about safety and security. If you cannot trust on a daily basis, if you're not committed to shoring up each other's sense of security and safety, then you have to ask yourself, why are you doing this at all?
Well, you know, that's really interesting that you focus so much on security and safety, because I know in looking at relationships, the ones that I see today, there's so much insecurity there in terms of of that relationship. And so, and going back to what you said about in tribes and in older kind of mindsets of where it's arranged marriage or relationships are very much vetted by others, you know. So is this something we've just kind of learned in our new society that this I get to make my, it's almost like a toddler, I want to make my own choice here and I don't want you to, contribute to my choice at all, and I'm going to do this in spite of it? Because I've seen even people get married in spite of people saying, I don't think this is a good idea, just because they want to prove someone wrong.
Well, we live in a culture that, you know, we have a statue of liberty. We don't have a statue of interdependency. And so we pray at the altar here in our culture, in the Western culture, I think in general, to the altar of autonomy. And it's a big misunderstanding because we are wired to interdepend. We are not autonomous beings. We are not. Mm. Our autonomy comes out of dependency. Those people who are autonomous without ever having depended are not really autonomous. They have adapted to neglect. So there's a lot of misinformation out there because of part of our culture is this way, part of our trajectory as a culture and society is this way, but we don't understand that we are fundamentally wired as animals to be dyadic, that means paired off, and to be interdependent. Anything else makes us wildly unhappy. A lot of this is education. But if you cannot be if you cannot play well with others, if you cannot collaborate, then you don't be in a relationship, get a dog. That's fine. But if that's what you want, then there are things that you will gain and not lose that you would never have been able to gain by yourself. That's just a fact. But a lot of us have come from family cultures where independence is the all-important thing, and there's a tremendous fear that one will lose their self or their stuff if they collaborate or, you know, become committed in a relationship. And that is actually not true. A truly secure functioning relationship is one where you gain, you do not lose. And then the rest of it is bargaining. But we have a problem in the West with something in attachment research we call avoidance, where we've sacrificed our ability to depend properly on another person in favor of this idea of autonomy, and we have a growing number of people who are tremendously lonely and are becoming more ill in their 40s and 50s because they are not socially networked. And we know that human beings, whether together with a partner or alone, if they're in isolation, they go mad. We go mad. So we have a lot. We have a ways to go to educate the population, but also to speak to something you just said. We are what we've experienced, and if we didn't see that with our parents, we didn't see our parents be good managers of each other, in love, being fully collaborative, then we're going to do the same thing. That's just a natural thing to do. So some of us saw this, some of us read about it in plays or movies, and some of us see other people doing it, and the rest of us have been through so many miserable experiences that we begin to learn. Later in life, and we meet somebody and say, been there, done that, let's just not do that again. Let's be ourselves. We're going to tell each other everything. We're not going to play around here. We understand the purpose of this relationship now, what's important, safety and security, trust, all of that working together. There's nothing like it. And we want people to be experts on each other. They need to have PhDs on each other.
I love that. I love that. You also talk about attachment theory in your book. And so what is the role that attachment plays in the dating process? Because it really is quite a big one. And what are the three different attachment types?
Well, attachment theory goes back to the 50s, and it just has to do with what was discovered to be a primary need in humans and primates, that above food, above other needs, is the need for physical contact and warmth. And that then goes into the human in a tether with the primary caregiver of trust and safety, being able to rely on that person for calming and soothing and for excitement, all of that stuff. And a secure attachment from childhood is one where the parents are energetically available, where there are no consequences for moving away or coming toward or clinging or distancing. All of that is tolerated. In these cultures, the relationship comes first above performance, above appearance and other matters. And these we consider secure infants and children. Anybody can change. This is quite fluid because our attachment experience is modified with every relationship. But because we start off a certain way, we may also begin to act in a certain way that repeats the same thing again and again. So in my family, I may come from a family that distances, and we're expected to perform and be independent and not be a bother, don't be needy. And then I go into adult relationships, and I don't like neediness. I like my own space. I'm addicted to my own alone time. And I could be perceived as threatening because another person wants more. And I may be threatened because I'm afraid that person is going to steal my soul. On the other side of the spectrum, I may be afraid of abandonment and punishment, because that's what I experience in my family. And so I go through adult relationships being very clingy and angry when the person is perceived to be withdrawing or rejecting from me. And I could become threatening to that person because I'm always on them. And that person could be threatening to me because I'm so acutely sensitive to them leaving me. And so I'm allergic to hope. And whenever I feel hope, I expect the next shoe to drop, and it's going to be terrible, and so it makes me a very angry person. These are normal outcomes. They're not pathology. These are simply adaptations to environment. So this is quite within the realm of nature. But it is a pain in the butt because people who are insecure come with certain fears that they really did experience, but they're just not there now, but they're there in their head, and so they create problems because of their fears. This doesn't mean that they can't be in a relationship. They just have to understand, you have to be with someone who's willing to learn how to work with that person, and vice versa.
Fantastic. So we really can grow beyond how we've been programmed or how we were raised or what we witnessed and expand. I love that. So we'll be back in just a few moments. Please stay tuned for more of Intuitive Transformations on OhmTimes.com.
Bringing a more conscious lifestyle to your world. OM Times Radio. IOM FM. Host your show on IOM FM, the radio network of OM Times Media, one of the more recognized brand names in the conscious community, and is backed by the extensive marketing reach of OM Times. Hosting a show on IOM FM immediately connects you with our extensive, dedicated community.
Did you just look down at your phone? You did it again, didn't you? You know, you're flying down the road in a 3-ton hunk of steel, and a text takes your eyes off the road for an average of 5 seconds. At 55 miles per hour, that's long enough to travel the length of a football field and cause some serious damage. Turn it off. Trust me. Whatever it is, you'll live.
Learn more at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Welcome back. This is Sylvia Henderson with Dr. Stan Patkin. And, you know, we've covered so much in this show already, but trust me, we've only scratched the surface of what is contained in this new book called Wired for Dating, How Understanding Neurobiology and Attachment Style Can Help You Find Your Ideal Mate by Dr. Stan Tatkin. And Dr. Tatkin, I'm pretty sure we can find this book on Amazon and at Barnes & Noble and most of the other book retail outlets, correct?
Oh, that's right. That's everywhere.
And how can people find out more about you? What's your website? Would you mind sharing that?
Sure. There are two websites. One is my personal one, stantatkin.com. And there people can find out retreats that we do. We do retreats all over the country. And we're doing one in Tuscany, Italy, this October. And those are wonderful. We follow Wired for Love as a structure. And then thepactinstitute.com, thepact, P-A-C-T, institute.com. And this is for mental health providers who are interested in psychobiology and research and what we do and want to be trained as a PACT therapist. And I recommend that people go there to look for that. And we do that all over the world as well.
Wonderful. So one of the other things that you really dig into in this book are the myths that we have about love. And there's about nine of them. So when you look at those nine myths, I think they're all valid areas to really put some focus upon, what are the top ones that you think that people stumble over the most, that cause the most problems for them when it comes to dating?
Well, I would say the top three are you've got to love yourself before you can love another person. You've got to know yourself before you can know another person. And there's a soulmate for you. let's start with the top. Those of us who research infant development, child development, know that loving yourself before you love another person is actually impossible. We never do anything inside first before we do it outside, or it's coming into us. The actual loving oneself is a process of interpersonal relating, not being in a cave or reading a book. You can't do that. It's always live and with another person. And the way you learn to love yourself is by loving another person very well, paying attention, and being available. I'm not talking about codependency. I'm talking about secure functioning. Mm-hmm. That's how you learn about yourself as well. That goes to the second one. The me that I know is the me that I know through all the close people in my life, past and current, and that me is constantly changing in my relationship to another person. So that takes care of that myth. And then, of course, if you're looking for your soulmate and you only have one of those, good luck. That's very depressing. You could say that once you're with somebody that you picked well with, they feel like your soulmate. That's fine. But if you're starting off thinking you got to find your soulmate, oh my God, what are the odds? So there are many, 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 many people out there that you could be in relationship with. All of them will offer some kind of different experience with you, but they're going to have some similarity in that we only pair bond with someone that we recognize and we find familiar. You're never going to pair bond with a stranger. That's too strange. You'll walk away from them. So no matter who you end up with, you've ended up with them because on some fundamental level you recognize them, which means you're going to be more alike than you're not. That's the way it works. Even though opposites attract on one level, on another level, you guys are peas in a pod, birds of a feather, and I could prove that.
Gotcha.
And that's a comfort, right? That's a comfort. But for other myths, though, which weren't in the book, I would like to direct people to my TED Talk because I think it's really important in terms of relationship that people start to understand the role of memory, perception, and communication, and how really terrible those three areas are for all human beings.
You know,
we're making a lot of mistakes all the time.
Yeah, especially because of memory. They say muscle has memory.
memory is not what people think. It's completely error prone. Communication is terrible even on a good day, and perceptions are like funhouse mirrors. They are always changing according to your state.
Yeah. And that really leads me right into my next question is, why do so many of us continuously pick the same type of partner over and over again?
Because we recognize them. Just because we picked them doesn't mean we picked wrong. what we end up feeling that we picked wrong is the person that we either won't play the game of secure functioning. In other words, they're threatening. They're too threatening, and they're not willing to not be that way. But the other, and this is very important, is that I pick the same kind of person, and that person is like others that I could not handle, dad, mom, brother, sister, or ex. And why I feel like I made a mistake is because I still don't know how to handle that experience. So I picked an angry person just like my dad. But that's not a mistake. I still need to learn how to deal with anger. I still need to learn how to handle an angry person. I still need to handle a person who doesn't tell the truth. I still need to handle a person who has a proneness to addiction. I still need to handle that person. And so that's why nature, I think, keeps serving it up. It's not that your picker is wrong. It's that we don't like that which we cannot manage. We don't like cars we can't drive. We don't like children that don't like us. We don't like dogs that don't lick. You know, things that we can't manage, we don't like. Think of it as I picked someone who's familiar to me, which is natural, but I still don't know how to be with that person. I still don't know how to manage myself with that energy or with that behavior. And many people who begin to learn to do this find that they pick just fine. So a lot of this isn't what it seems.
So say someone tends to pick because maybe their father was an alcoholic or abusive, and they find people that are abusive, maybe not in exactly the same way, but similar. It's because they're trying to resolve that they didn't resolve with their earlier relationship with their father. How do you break that cycle, though? Because that doesn't lead to a very effective relationship, a secure functioning relationship.
That's right. Well, I've met you, and let's pick a feature. You tend to be dismissive, just like my family member. Okay, you're dismissive, and that's dangerous to me. That's threatening to me, and you tend to be, you tend to withdraw a lot and make me feel like I'm alone. So my being able to manage that is first key. Secondly, if we are not on the same page in terms of what this relationship is, in other words, the relationship comes first, therefore you can't do that. If you want to be in this relationship, you can't just walk away and stay away for days. That's not going to work. If that's what you want, you're fired. So there has to be an idea of what secure functioning is, and is this person willing to play? Not that they are perfect, because no one is, not that they are someone who's completely opposite of something that you don't like, but that they're willing to play by the rules that protect both of you. And if they aren't, that's what rules them out. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So someone who has an addiction issue has to take it under their own control if they want to have a secure functioning relationship with me. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't have this addiction proneness, but they have to rein it in because that interferes with secure function. So the emphasis here is not on abuse, cheating, lying, or addiction. It's on secure functioning. If people are agreeing to that, there isn't time to cheat. There isn't time to get into a lot of addiction, because that's getting in the way actually of secure functioning. It's a smarter way of looking at it. Otherwise, people will be looking at the pieces and not at the big picture. In secure functioning, we put the relationship first. We're available to each other. We don't allow third things to come between us. Therefore, secure functioning competes with these other behaviors. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
And if you're not willing to, it's fine. It's fine that you're an alcoholic, but if you want to be with me, that's going to have to be reined in. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to do it.
That's good. So that really kind of dovetails into the next question, which is a little bit of a biggie. And what is the best way for someone to end a dating relationship? And how do you know that ending that relationship is your next best step, which I think you just answered by it has to, the relationship has to follow the guidelines that you outline about a secure functioning relationship. So when you notice further down the road into this relationship, say 6 months, 9 months before that year is up, or even at that 12-month mark, that this isn't going to work, we're not in a secure functioning relationship, what's the best way to end a dating relationship at that point?
Well, to end it properly, which is not to ghost people, which is a thing that people are doing a lot now, which is just disappear. But hopefully it's very clear to the other person why you are opting out of the relationship, and hopefully it's because this person is not matching up with what your ideals are about a secure functioning relationship. So here's an example. If I believe that shared principles of governance, which is to be good for me and you, is what's going to carry us through the day, because again, this is survival unit, right, that we're creating. But you are showing yourself not to be believing in that, and you want to do your own thing. Let's say it is staying in touch with all your old girlfriends or boyfriends or whatever, and that violates one of the principles of us first, then you're fired. It's not a good or bad thing. It's just that won't go. That's not good for me. I don't think it's good for you either, but that doesn't matter. It's not good for me, and therefore that won't work. If people would do this, then they would actually find a relationship that will be stable. But people are reluctant because I love her. I love him, you know, and they ignore these things when it's right there out in the open. This is a deal breaker. This person at this point in their life does not believe the same thing you do. And that is going to cause much grief. And if you have children, that is going to carry down to them as well. So, this is a time to be very judicious and to be very thoughtful and not penny wise, pound foolish. Think ahead. This is a very serious relationship that depends on trust. And if there's the least doubt, if somebody is doing something to play around with that, they should not be in your orbit, period.
Yeah. I think that's where
friends come into play to help as well.
Wonderful. Wow, I cannot believe we're at the end of the hour already.
I know, Sylvia.
That went so fast. This was wonderful. Dr. Stan Tatkin, thank you so very much for joining me on the show.
You've
been a wonderful guest. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please go out and get Dr. Stan Tatkin's book if you're single, Wired for Dating, if you're in a long-term relationship or married. Wired for Love, it can only improve your life by improving your relationship. Have a wonderful day. Thank you for listening. I love you all, and God bless. Bye-bye for now.
Bye, Sylvia.